Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for November 29, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. On the front page, the head article is More Hostages Are Home. Mediators gather in Qatar to try to extend temporary ceasefire. Hamas and Israel released more hostages and prisoners under terms of a fragile ceasefire that held for a fifth day Tuesday as international mediators in Qatar worked to extend the truce. The United States, meanwhile, urged Israel to better protect Palestinian civilians in Gaza if it follows through on its promise to resume the war. In the latest swap since the ceasefire began Friday, Israel said Hamas freed 10 of its citizens and two Thai nationals who returned to Israel. Soon after, Israel released 30 Palestinian prisoners. The truce was due to end after one more exchange Wednesday night. For the first time, Israel and Hamas blamed each other for an exchange of fire between troops and militants in northern Gaza. There was no immediate indication it would endanger the truce, which enabled some humanitarian aid to flow into Gaza. CIA Director William Burns and David Barnea, who heads Israel's Mossad intelligence agency, were in Qatar, a key mediator with Hamas, to discuss extending the ceasefire and releasing more hostages, a diplomat said, on condition of anonymity. A U.S. official confirmed Burns was in Qatar, speaking anonymously because the director's travel plans are not publicized for security reasons. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was scheduled to visit the region this week, also with an eye to extending the truce. Israel vows to resume the war with full force to destroy Hamas once it's clear that no more hostages will be freed under the deal. The Biden administration told Israel it must avoid, quote, significant further displacement, close quote, of and mass casualties among Palestinian civilians if it resumes its offensive, and must operate with more precision in southern Gaza than it has in the north, according to U.S. officials. The officials spoke on condition of anonymity under ground rules set by the White House. Hamas and other militants still hold about 160 hostages out of 240 seized in their October 7 assault into southern Israel that ignited the war. Israel says it is willing to extend the ceasefire by one day for every 10 additional hostages Hamas releases, according to the deal brokered by the Qatar, Egypt, and the U.S. Hamas is expected to make much higher demands for the release of captive Israeli soldiers. Israel vows to end Hamas' 16-year rule in Gaza and crush its military capabilities. That would almost certainly require expanding its ground offensive from northern Gaza to the south, where most of Gaza's population of 2.3 million is now crowded. It's unclear where they would go if Israel does so, as Egypt refuses to accept refugees and Israel sealed its border. Captives released, the latest group of Israeli hostages freed from Gaza, 9 women and a 17-year-old, was flown to hospitals in Israel, the Israeli military said. Tuesday's hostage release brought to 60 the number of Israelis freed during the truce. An additional 21 hostages, 19 Thais, one Filipino, and one Russian-Israeli, have been released in separate negotiations since the truce began. Before the truce, Hamas released 4 Israeli hostages and the Israeli army rescued one. 2 other hostages were found dead in Gaza. The latest swap brought to 180 the number of Palestinian women and teens freed from Israeli prisons. Most were teenagers accused of throwing stones and firebombs during the confrontations with Israeli forces. Several released women were convicted by Israeli military courts of attempting to carry out deadly attacks. The prisoners are widely seen by Palestinians as heroes resisting occupation. Northern Gaza in ruins. The ceasefire allowed residents who remained in Gaza City and other parts of the north to venture out to survey the destruction and try to locate and bury relatives. In northern Gaza's Jabalia refugee camp, which Israel bombarded heavily for weeks and which troops surrounded in heavy fighting with militants, you come across whole city blocks that have been demolished. Just a pancake of concrete layered as buildings have collapsed, said Thomas White, the Gaza director for the UN agency caring for Palestinian refugees. The agency delivered 6 trucks of aid to the camp, including supplies for a medical center. Footage of White's visit showed streets lined with destroyed buildings, cars, and piles of rubble. A UN-led aid consortium estimates that across Gaza, more than 234,000 homes have been damaged and 46,000 destroyed, amounting to about 60% of the territory's housing. In the north, the destruction severely compromises the ability to meet basic requirements to sustain life, it said. More than 13,300 Palestinians have been killed since the war began, about two-thirds of them women and minors, according to the health ministry in Hamas-ruled Gaza, which does not differentiate between civilians and combatants. Israel says more than 1,200 people have been killed in its side, mostly civilians killed in the initial attack. Authorities were able to reopen the dialysis department at Gaza City's Shifa Hospital after medical teams brought a small generator. About 20 patients there went 2 or 3 weeks without dialysis. Dr. Mutasim Salah told Al Jazeera TV from the hospital. 2 weeks ago, Israeli forces seized the hospital, which Israel claimed was used as a major base by Hamas, an accusation that the group and hospital staff deny. Also on the front page, an article entitled "Push for Progress, Fueling Catastrophic Climate Crisis." Amid record high temperatures, deluges, droughts, and wildfires, leaders are convening for another round of United Nations climate talks this month that seek to curb a centuries-long trend of humans spewing ever more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. For hundreds of years, people have shaped the world around them for their benefit. They drained lakes, deforested lands, and mined for metals and minerals to grow wealth and economies. They dug up billions of tons of coal and then oil and gas to fuel empires and economies. The allure of exploiting nature and burning fossil fuels as a path to prosperity hopped from nation to nation, each eager to secure their own cheap energy. Over hundreds of years, that impulse has remade the planet's climate, too, and brought its inhabitants to the brink of catastrophe. Anya Zilberstein, a historian of climate science at Concordia University in Montreal, highlighted Europeans colonizing the Americas in the 16th and 17th centuries as a major factor in today's climate and environmental crises. They bring with them this idea that conquest and then the development of the cultivation of landscapes, like taking down trees, opening up lands to European-style agriculture, that the draining of swamps will also change the climate, usually for the better, Silberstein said. Jan Galinsky, a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire, said Europeans of the time thought that their changes, cutting down forests, draining swamps, plowing land, would change the climate as well, to something closer to their homelands. He said they saw this engineering as positive. They believed that their society was making progress, Galinsky said. That early modern period solidified notions of industry, progress, productivity, and growth that make it harder to tackle the current climate crisis, Zilberstein said. Then in the 18th and 19th centuries, the balance tipped dramatically in coal's favor as an energy source. Through technological advances like steam power, new transportation routes like canals and later railroads, and a desire to better control how, when, and where energy was used. Steam power made it easier for factory workers to control labor and nature in an economy based on water power, for example, because they could be set up anywhere and weren't vulnerable to floods or droughts, said Andreas Malm, an associate professor of human ecology at Lund University in Sweden. The British then forcibly exported this model and integrated other countries, such as India or Egypt, or what became Nigeria, into a kind of an economy that was dependent on fossil fuel, said Malm. Other nations then began searching for fossil fuels in various places in the Ottoman Empire, in the Indian subcontinent and elsewhere, said Onbarik, a historian at Tel Aviv University and co-founder of the Laboratory for the History of Climate Change. Then came oil. Oil use grew in the late 19th century because it wasn't as labor-intensive as coal, whose workers now had strong unions in some Western nations, historians say. Like coal, oil was easy to store, it's more energy-rich than coal, and it's easier to move. As a liquid, it can be shipped through pipes as well as by trucks, tankers, and rail cars, said J.R. McNeil, a historian at Georgetown University. By the 20th century, the growth in oil helped fuel technologies like cars and air travel that became more affordable in many global north countries. Other nations, such as China, Japan, and India, began assembling their own energy regimes based on fossil fuels. As Europe, the US, and Japan built their energy systems around internal combustion engines, it made the global investment in an oil-dominated fossil fuel regime gigantic and harder, but not impossible, to reverse or replace, McNeil said. Meanwhile, coal kept its place in the global economy. In China and Japan, growing consumption was a signal and barometer of developing economies, said Victor Xiao, a historian of science at Harvard University. After the Communist Revolution in 1949, the Chinese government measured growth by its production of items like cloth, electricity, wheat, iron, steel, and coal, too. Japan studied Western mining to develop their own coal fields. China is now the world's largest greenhouse gas emitter, although the United States still trumps it historically. India has also become a major coal-burning nation. Frederick Albritton Johnson, a historian at the University of Chicago, said humans can decide what kind of world they want to live in and tailor their development within nature's boundaries. There are two kinds of boundaries to this economy, said Frederick Albritton Johnson, a historian at the University of Chicago. One is a sort of upper boundary of planetary limits, of what our natural world can withstand. And then there's a lower boundary. That would guarantee minimum social needs, entitlements, the right to education, the right to clean water, the right to a steady income. On page 2, an article, Adopt an Axolotl campaign launches. Effort aims to save iconic water monster from pollution and trout. Ecologists from Mexico's National Autonomous University have relaunched a fundraising campaign to bolster conservation efforts for axolotls, an iconic endangered fish-like type of salamander. The campaign, called Adopt Axolotl, asks people for as little as 600 pesos, about $35, to virtually adopt one of the tiny water monsters. Virtual adoption comes from with live updates on your axolotl's health. For less, donors can buy one of the creatures a virtual dinner. In their main habitat, the population density of Mexican axolotls has plummeted 99.5% in under 2 decades, according to scientists behind the fundraiser. Last year's Adopt an Ajolotl's campaign raised just over 450,000 pesos, $26,300, toward an experimental captive breeding program and efforts to restore more habitat in the ancient Aztec canals of Huachimilco, a southern borough of Mexico City. Still, there are not enough resources for thorough research, said Alejandro Calhada, an ecologist surveying less well-known species of axolotls for the government's Environment Department. We lack a big monitoring of all the streams in Mexico City, let alone the whole country, said Calhada, who leads a team of 9 researchers. For this large area, it is not enough. Despite the creature's recent rise to popularity, almost all 18 species of axolotl in Mexico remain critically endangered, threatened by encroaching water pollution, a deadly amphibian fungus, and non-native rainbow trout. While scientists could once find 6,000 axolotls on average per half a square mile in Mexico, there are now only 36, according to the National Autonomous University's latest census. A more recent international study found less than 1,000 Mexican axolotls left in the wild. Luis Zambrano Gonzalez, one of the university's scientists, announced the fundraiser and said he hopes to begin a new census, the first since 2014, in March. There is no more time for Chimilico, said Zambrano. The invasion of pollution is very strong. Soccer fields, floating dens, it's very sad. Without data on the number and distribution of different axolotl species in Mexico, it is hard to know how long the creatures have left and where to prioritize what resources are available. What I know is that we have to work urgently, said Calzada. Axolotls have grown into a cultural icon in Mexico for their unique, admittedly slimy appearance and uncanny ability to regrow limbs. In labs around the world, scientists think this healing power could hold the secret to tissue repair and even cancer recovery. In the past, government conservation programs have largely focused on the most popular species, the Mexican axolotl found in Huachimilco. But other species can be found across the country, from tiny streams in the Valley of Mexico to the northern Sonora Desert. Mexico City's expanding urbanization has damaged the water quality of the canals. While in lakes around the capital, rainbow trout, which escape from farms, can displace axolotls and eat their food. Calzada said his team is increasingly finding axolotls dead from chytrid fungus, a skin-eating disease causing catastrophic amphibian die-offs from Europe to Australia. While academics rely on donations and Calzada's team turns to a core of volunteers, the Mexican government recently approved an 11% funding cut for its Environment Department. Over its 6-year term, the administration of President Andrés Manuel López Obrador will have given 35% less money to the country's Environment Department than its predecessor, according to an analysis of Mexico's 2024 budget. And now on page 3, we find an article entitled First Lady Remembered. Jimmy Carter, 99, now in hospice, makes a rare public appearance. Rosalind Carter was memorialized Tuesday as a matriarch who felt most comfortable among the impoverished and vulnerable, as she was mourned by a rare gathering of all living U.S. first ladies and multiple presidents, including her 99-year-old husband, Jimmy Carter. The tribute service marked the second day of a three-day schedule of public events celebrating the former First Lady and global humanitarian who died November 19 at home in Plains, Georgia, at age 96. Tributes began Monday in the Carter's native Sumter County and continued at Glenn Memorial Church in Atlanta. "My mother was the glue that held our family together through the ups and downs and thicks and thins of our family's politics," her son, James Earl Chip Carter III, said. The former president, who is 10 months into home hospice care and hadn't been seen in public since September, watched from his wheelchair, reclining and covered by a blanket featuring his wife's face, with Chip and his daughter Amy holding his hands. Their other sons, Jeff and Jack, flanked them. "He never wants to be very far from her," Carter Center CEO Paige Alexander said. President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden, their longtime friends, joined them in the front row, along with former President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and former First Ladies Melania Trump, Michelle Obama, and Laura Bush. Vice President Kamala Harris and Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff paid their respects, as did Georgia's U.S. Senators and Governor Brian Kemp and his wife Marty. More than 1,000 people, including a sizable contingent of Secret Service agents, filled the sanctuary. Former Presidents Donald Trump, Barack Obama, and George W. Bush were invited but didn't attend. The service reflected Rosalind Carter's status as a global figure while emphasizing her more private profile as a family matriarch who preferred a simple life. She had met kings and queens, presidents, others in authority, powerful corporate leaders, and celebrities, Chip Carter said. She said the people that she felt the most comfortable with and the people she enjoyed being with the most were those that lived in absolute abject poverty. The pews filled with political power players, but front and center were her children and dozens of grandchildren and great-grandchildren, all surrounding Jimmy Carter, who grieved not as a former president, but as her partner of 77 years. And now a story from India, construction workers rescued. Massive operation has a happy ending for crew trapped in a tunnel. 41 construction workers emerged dazed and smiling Tuesday from a collapsed tunnel in northern India, where they spent the last 17 days. A happy ending to an ordeal that gripped the country and led to a massive rescue operation that overcame several setbacks. Locals, relatives, and government officials erupted in joy, set off firecrackers, and shouted, "Bharat Mata Ki Jai!" Indy for long live Mother India, as happy workers walked out after receiving a brief checkup by doctors. Officials hung garlands around their necks as the crowd cheered. Nitin Gadkari, the country's Minister of Road Transport and Highways, said in a video posted on social media that he was completely relieved and happy that all of the workers were rescued from the Silkiara Tunnel in Uttarkashi, a town in India's northern state of Uttarakhand. "This was a well-coordinated effort by multiple agencies, marking one of the most significant rescue operations in recent years," Gadkari said. No one was seriously injured or killed when a landslide caused a section of the 2.8-mile tunnel about 220 yards from the entrance to collapse early on the morning of November 12. The workers were finishing their shifts, and many were likely looking forward to celebrating Diwali, the Hindu festival of lights, that day. The workers had light in the collapsed tunnel, and since early in their ordeal, they were provided with food, water, and oxygen through pipes. More than a dozen doctors, including psychiatrists, were also at the site monitoring their health. Officials said all 41 workers made it through the ordeal in good health before emerging to the cameras and crowds and being whisked away in ambulances. Each was given a checkup at a makeshift medical camp and the tunnel entrance. The rescue was originally expected to last only a few days, but a series of setbacks led to its expansion and to the workers being trapped for more than 2 weeks. The workers were extracted one by one on a wheeled stretcher that was pulled through a yard-wide tunnel of welded pipes that crews pushed through the dugout space. Most of the workers were migrant laborers from throughout the country. And next, an article entitled "Official Indicates Fed Could Start Cutting Rates." Board member says inflation would need to continue slowing trend. A key Federal Reserve official raised the possibility Tuesday that the Fed could decide to cut its benchmark interest rate as early as spring if inflation keeps declining steadily. The official, Christopher Waller, a member of the Fed's Board of Governors, cautioned that inflation is still too high and that it's not yet certain if a recent slowdown in price increases can be sustained. But he sounded the most optimistic notes of any Fed official since the central bank launched its aggressive streak of rate hikes in March 2022, and he suggested the central bank is likely done raising rates. Waller is regarded as a relatively hawkish official, meaning he typically favors higher rates to combat inflation rather than low rates to boost job growth. He also is somewhat of a bellwether for the Fed's overall rate-setting committee. If inflation continues to cool for several more months, I don't know how long that might be, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, that we feel confident that inflation is really down and on its way, you could then start lowering the policy rate just because inflation is lower, he told the American Enterprise Institute. Next, Hunter Biden offers to publicly testify to panel. Hunter Biden offered Tuesday to testify publicly before Congress, striking a defiant note in response to a subpoena from Republicans and setting up a potential high-stakes face-off even as a separate special counsel probe unfolds and his father, President Joe Biden, campaigns for re-election. The Democratic president's son slammed the subpoena's request for closed-door testimony, saying it can be manipulated. Representative James Comer of Kentucky, the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, stood firm, saying Republicans expect full cooperation with their original demand for a deposition. Hunter Biden's lawyer called the inquiry a fishing expedition, a response in line with the more forceful legal approach he's taken in recent months as congressional Republicans pursue an impeachment inquiry seeking to tie his father to his business dealings. Republicans so far failed to uncover evidence directly implicating President Biden in wrongdoing. Comer said Tuesday the president's son could testify publicly in the future, but he expects him to sit for a deposition on December 13 as outlined in the subpoena. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for November 29, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. Thanks for listening. Hello, and welcome to the reading of The Messenger for November 29, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. On the front page, the lead article is entitled GOP Candidate, quote, "I Favor Revolution." Ramaswamy says he believes in speaking truth. If the framers were alive today, they'd say it's time for a second American Revolution. Most Republicans favor reform. I favor revolution. These words by Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy pretty much sum up the tone of his visit to Webster City Tuesday afternoon at the Briggs Woods Conference Center. Addressing a crowd of approximately 70 area residents, he introduced himself and what he stands for. Ramaswamy said he believes in speaking truth. even when it needs to be spoken to members of his own party. He believes in pursuing an America First policy, and if elected, he said, he would achieve that by shutting down the administrative deep state, declaring independence from communist China, unleashing the American economy, and achieving greater than 5% GDP, gross domestic product, growth, and reviving American national identity. When asked what inspired him to run for president, he said, I used to be a CEO. I've been an entrepreneur who's founded successful companies. But I couldn't revive our national identity through that. I took on the bureaucracy of Big Pharma. I've taken on the bureaucracy of the ESG, Environmental, Social, and Governance Cartel, in the U.S. and abroad. But part of what's missing is that we need a leader who revives who we are as Americans. Regarding his two sons and their generation, he said, I'm worried that they're not going to have the same American dream that my wife, Apurva, and I had to grow up in this country. Ramaswamy was born and raised in Cincinnati, Ohio. He said the cornerstone of his campaign is, revive our national identity in this country. Answer who we are as Americans. This is what this is about. His domestic agenda calls for shutting down the, quote, deep state of administrative bureaucracy, close quote. On the global stage, keep us out of World War III and declare independence from China, he added. He believes that he is able to revive pride in the next generation through civic education and reform education in the United States. I am an American First leader, but from the next generation with fresh legs and the energy to get this done. Ramaswamy's wife is a throat surgeon and assistant professor at Ohio State University. They live in Columbus, Ohio. Also on the front page, an article entitled Share What You Wear, discontinued. Iowa Central encourages donations to other local agencies. Unlike in years past, Iowa Central Community College's Career Education Building isn't going to be packed to the gills with new and gently used clothing, toys, household items, and more, while shoppers snake their way through the maze of donations this weekend. For 18 years, Iowa Central hosted Share What You Wear, an annual service project with students and community members focused on assisting those in need over the holiday season. It appears the 2022 event was the final version of it. On October 31, Vice President of Student Services, Tom Beneke, sent an email to college faculty and staff informing them that the college would not be hosting Share What You Wear this year. We are recommending that our team donate to local organizations instead of giving to the college's Share What You Wear program, Beneke wrote in the email. We are encouraging donations of gently used items to organizations such as The Key on Central for DSAOC, the Second Chance Thrift Store for the Beacon of Hope Shelter, and One Vision General Store or their charity of choice. Samantha Reeves, Dean of Student Services, confirmed that Share What You Wear has been discontinued at Iowa Central. Collectively, our organization donates to local organizations and puts forth other efforts into giving back to our community, Reeves said. So that was kind of the conversation. We're going to reevaluate this year, and we're going to donate to those organizations instead of doing Share What You Wear. Reeves said she's working with One Vision, one of the organizations the college would work with during Share What You Wear, to hold a drop-in drive at some point. One Vision would set up their drive-in trailer, and then students, faculty, and community members would be able to donate stuff, and then One Vision can use them for their organizational purposes, she said. I know a lot of people are wanting to donate items or have mentioned donating items, so this is going to be a great opportunity that they'll be able to. Reeves was unable to share specifically why the decision to discontinue Share What You Wear was made, and referred the messenger to Beneke for that information. The messenger reached out to Beneke several times by phone and email over the last few weeks, and as of press time on Tuesday, had not received a response. Each year, Iowa Central reviews the impact it makes in Fort Dodge and the surrounding area, Beneke wrote in the October 31 email to staff. The list of partnerships through volunteering has grown substantially as enrollment increased and students started new traditions. Iowa Central is very involved in activities, including the annual Fort Dodge Ford Thanksgiving Dinner, hosting different festivals such as the recent Afro-Latino Festival and STEAM Fest, participating in the Purple Walk for Alzheimer's, providing instrumental music for the Brushy Creek Area Honor Flight, making blankets for community groups, serving meals to the less fortunate, participating in community parades, hosting youth camps, various photography projects to highlight communities and organizations, parking cars for the Cruise to the Woods show, and many, many more. Share What You Wear began in 2004 as a joint effort of the Iowa Central Student Senate and the Phi Theta Kappa Honor Society. Over the years, it grew to involve the entire campus community of students, faculty, and staff. In preparation for the event, typically held the first weekend in December, students would begin collecting donated items in November. Throughout the month, they'd sort the donations by type and size and set up tables and tables of items in the Career Education Building. On the day of the event, it was common for hundreds of people to line up outside the doors, waiting for it to open so they could shop for what they need. Unlike most shopping trips, though, these items didn't cost them anything. Neither did the gift wrapping. For many of those who have attended Share What You Wear over the years, the event has provided some relief during the holidays for families with tight budgets. Janet Earls, who volunteered at Share What You Wear for many years, told The Messenger in 2021 that she had people tell her, "If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't have a Christmas." And finally on the front page, an article entitled "Holly Jolly Christmas Project Comes to Fort Dodge. Tree Kits to be Provided to Families in Need." 'Tis the season for giving, and Katie Royster and her family always look for ways to make the holidays bright and help their neighbors in need. "Our family wants to do something, and we always hear about Bikes for Tykes on the radio and the Giving Tree gifts and things like that," she said. But a connection with an old friend and Fort Dodge native, Augie Hettinger Slaughter, gave Royster a new idea on how to help. "Angie noticed that a lot of people didn't have Christmas trees," Royster said. "So it's like we have all these presents, but where are we going to put them?" Slaughter started the Holly Jolly Christmas Project 3 years ago in Omaha, where she now lives. The project provides Christmas tree kits to families in need. Each kit contains a pre-lit Christmas tree, set of ornaments, ornament hooks, and a tree topper. In the program's first 2 years, 180 Christmas tree kits were delivered to elementary school students in the Omaha metro area. After learning about the Omaha program, Royster collaborated with Slaughter to bring the Holly Jolly Christmas Project to Fort Dodge this year. Royster works for the Fort Dodge Community School District and worked with the district to send out a survey to all elementary school families to ask if they had a need for a holiday tree. "From that survey, there were 42 families signed up," Royster said. "We had an optional spot where they could write why they felt they were in a hardship or needed a tree, and some of the stories were just horrible when you read them," she said. "It just makes me feel very privileged to have had a Christmas tree my whole life." Royster, who worked with St. Paul Lutheran School and St. Edmund Catholic School to identify a few of their families in need, In all, there are about 52 families signed up to receive the Christmas tree kits. Over the last month, Royster has collected donations, both monetary and materials, for the kits and currently has enough supplies to make 60 Christmas tree kits. A GoFundMe was created for the project and it raised $2,320. Donations will close on Friday and families will be able to pick up their Christmas tree kits this weekend at Duncombe Elementary School. They're going to kind of shop, so they get to pick out what tree they want. With any leftover kits, Royster plans to check with the schools to see if any families were overlooked and reach out to local daycare centers to see if they have families in need. We're just trying to get as many of the kits out the door as possible, she said. Whatever's left after that will be packed up and put away for 2024. I definitely think it's going to be something we do again next year, Royster said. Because the trees are all artificial, the families who receive them can also pack them away at the end of the season to bring out next Christmas. On page 2, an article entitled "The Messenger Donates to Growth Alliance." The Messenger recently donated some of the proceeds generated by the publication of All About Greater Fort Dodge to the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance, which uses the magazine to market the community. Terry Christensen, the publisher of The Messenger, presented the donation. He was joined by Dina McCauley, Operations Coordinator of the Growth Alliance, Emily Ayers, Administrative Assistant for the Alliance, Astra Ferris, Chief Executive Officer of the Alliance, Jefferson Fossbender, Economic Development Director for the Alliance, and Skyla Porter, Marketing Director for the Alliance. The Messenger is proud to partner with the Growth Alliance for this wonderful annual publication, Christensen said. It is exciting to showcase the many positive things going on in our community and around the region. The Growth Alliance staff works tirelessly, providing the content and photos. And of course, the local advertising support allows this to come together. And now an article from Newtown, Connecticut, entitled "Sandy Hook Families Offer to Settle Alex Jones' $1.5 Billion Legal Debt." The Sandy Hook families, who won nearly $1.5 billion in legal judgments against conspiracy theorist Alex Jones for calling the 2012 Connecticut school shooting a hoax, have offered to settle that debt for only pennies on the dollar, at least $85 million over 10 years. The offer was made in Jones' personal bankruptcy case in Houston last week. In a legal filing, lawyers for the families said they believed the proposal was a viable way to help resolve the bankrupt reorganization cases of both Jones and his company, Free Speech Systems. But in the sharply worded document, the attorneys continued to accuse the InfoWars host of failing to curb his personal spending and extravagant lifestyle, failing to preserve the value of his holdings, refusing to sell assets, and failing to produce certain financial documents. Jones has failed in every way to serve as the fiduciary mandated by the bankruptcy code in exchange for the breathing spell he has enjoyed for almost a year. His time is up, lawyers for the Sandy Hook families wrote. The family's lawyers offered Jones two options: either liquidate his estate and give the proceeds to creditors, or pay them at least $8.5 million a year for 10 years, plus 50% of any income over $9 million per year. During a court hearing in Houston, Jones' personal bankruptcy lawyer, Vicki Driver, suggested Monday that the $8.5 million 10-year settlement offer was too high and unrealistic for Jones to pay. On page 3, we find an article entitled "Fort Dodge Police Department Investigating Walmart Threat." The Fort Dodge Police Department is investigating a threat of violence that was allegedly written on a bathroom stall in the Fort Dodge Walmart at 3036 First Avenue South. On Tuesday morning, the department's official Facebook page shared a post stating, "We have been made aware of a post on social media regarding Walmart. This incident is currently under investigation." The social media post referenced appears to be a photo of some graffiti purportedly on a Walmart bathroom stall threatening to, quote, "shoot it up tomorrow," close quote, giving Tuesday's date. The store remained open on Tuesday. The messenger reached out to Walmart corporate media relations to ask what protocol the company has for threats of violence at its stores and who within the company decides if a threat is credible enough to close the store. No response was received by press time on Tuesday. The Fort Dodge Police Department did not release any more information about the incident. Anyone with information should call 515-573-2323. The Messenger's editorial today is entitled "Video Highlights Local Farmers Agribusiness." It is a reminder of the good things found in Fort Dodge and Webster County. The great things local farmers and agribusinesses are doing are highlighted in a film that will be viewed worldwide online. It's called "Fort Dodge is Incredible." It was produced by Land O'Lakes and New Cooperative. Its imagery includes combines churning through bountiful fields and sweeping overhead vistas of downtown. Included are voiceovers by area farmers Brian Wagner and Laura Bunda, Dan Dix, the general manager of New Cooperative, Emily Stuckey, co-owner of Community Orchard, and Jesse Ulrich, president of Iowa Central Community College. It drives home the point that Fort Dodge is a vibrant community that helps to produce the nation's food. Obviously, there are thousands of rural communities that could have been selected for a video. Fort Dodge was picked because, according to Heather Malinchek, chief marketing officer of Land O'Lakes, it is a very good example of the kind of vibrant community the company wanted to highlight. "The community values are pretty powerful," she said. Links on the New Cooperative, Land O'Lakes, and City of Fort Dodge social media pages will take viewers to the film. It is also on YouTube.com. We encourage everyone to take a couple minutes to watch it. It has beautiful images of the area and packs a lot of information into a short time frame. The fact that it was made at all is a huge compliment to our community. Too often, folks in Fort Dodge are their own worst enemy when it comes to complaining about the community. While locals might bash their town, a huge company with national, if not global, reach is declaring with this video that Fort Dodge is incredible. It is vibrant and has powerful community values. Perhaps it is hard for those who are here to remember that all the time. This new video serves as a dramatic reminder of all the good things we have. On page 5, we find an article entitled "Honoring Rosalynn Carter. Family, friends, first ladies, and presidents pay their respects." Rosalynn Carter was remembered Tuesday as a former U.S. First Lady who leveraged her fierce intellect and political power to put her deep Christian faith into action by always helping others, especially those who needed it most. A gathering of first ladies and presidents, including her 99-year-old husband, Jimmy Carter, joined other political figures in tribute. But a parade of speakers said her global stature wasn't what defined her. She had met kings and queens, presidents, others in authority, powerful corporate leaders, and celebrities, her son, James Earl Chip Carter III, said. She said the people that she felt the most comfortable with and the people she enjoyed being with the most were those that lived in absolute abject poverty,
The ones without adequate housing, without a proper diet, and without access to health care. The service was held during 3 days of events celebrating the humanitarian who died November 19 at home in Plains, Georgia, at the age of 96. Tributes began Monday in the Carters' native Sumter County and continued at Glenn Memorial Church in Atlanta. Her funeral and burial are planned for Wednesday in her small hometown. Jimmy Carter, who is 10 months into home hospice care, watched from his wheelchair, reclining and covered by a blanket featuring his wife's face. Chip and his sister Amy held their father's hands and were flanked by their brothers Jeff and Jack. President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden, the Carters' longtime friends, joined them in the front row, along with former President Bill Clinton, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and the other living former First Ladies, Melania Trump, Michelle Obama, and Laura Bush. Vice President Kamala Harris and Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff paid their respects, as did Georgia's U.S. Senators and Governor Brian Kemp and his wife, Marty. More than 1,000 people, including a sizable contingent of Secret Service agents, filled the sanctuary. Former Presidents Donald Trump, Barack Obama, and George W. Bush were invited, but did not attend. My mother was the glue that held our family together through the ups and downs and thicks and thins of our family's politics, Chip Carter said. The pews filled with political power players, but front and center were her children and dozens of grandchildren and great-grandchildren, all surrounding Jimmy Carter, her partner of 77 years. Their partnership and love story was a defining feature of her life, said Amy Carter, who read a love note her father wrote to her mother 75 years ago. Journalist Judy Woodruff recalled Rosalind Carter lobbying lawmakers, campaigning separately from her husband, attending cabinet meetings, and playing key roles, including being the first presidential advisor to suggest Camp David as a negotiating place for Egypt's Anwar Sadat and Israel's Menachem Begin. Those negotiations led to historic peace accords between the two countries. Without Rosalind Carter, I don't believe there would have been a President Carter, Woodruff said. It was Jimmy Carter's first public appearance since he entered hospice care, other than a brief ride with Rosalind in September's Plains Peanut Festival parade, where they were visible only through the open windows of a Secret Service vehicle. He was with his wife during her final hours, but did not appear publicly during the earlier events at her alma mater, Georgia Southwestern State University in Americus, and at his presidential library. He never wants to be very far from her, Carter Center CEO Paige Alexander said. The trip to Atlanta was hard for the former president, but this is her last trip up, and it's probably his too, she added. He's determined. The Carters married in 1946 and became the longest married presidential couple in U.S. history. Jimmy Carter was the longest-lived president. Rosalind Carter was the second-longest-lived first lady, trailing only Bess Truman, who died at 97. We also find several news briefs on page 5, first of which is Questions Remain in India Rescue. The rescue mission was expected to last only a few days. Instead, it took 17 days to reach 41 construction workers who were trapped when a landslide collapsed a mountain tunnel in northern India earlier this month. The excruciating wait finally ended at nightfall on Tuesday, as temperatures dropped near the accident site in the mountainous state of Uttarakhand. Everyone was pulled out alive. But beyond the jubilation and relief, questions remain as to why what became one of the most significant and complicated rescue operations in India's recent history, aided by international tunneling experts and spearheaded by multiple rescue agencies, took so long? News of the trapped workers spread fast after a November 12 early morning landslide caused a portion of the 2.8-mile Silkira tunnel they were building near the town of Uttarkashi in Uttarakhand state to collapse about 650 feet from the entrance. No one was seriously injured or killed in the collapse, but the engineers on the team knew they had their task cut out for them. They had to penetrate through rocks and metal to reach the workers trapped behind a wall of nearly 170 feet of debris.